Hey, 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 Kevin Guthrie here, talking all things mental health. Thank you so much for listening to another one of our podcasts. We have a guest in the studio, as always. We have the lovely Lisa Hartford. Lisa, thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you.
It's great to have you in the studio. We're going to start off, as we always do, with our listener questions. The question was, what's the difference between hypnotherapy and counselling? I'm going to go answer this and then I'm going to pass on to Lisa to answer it as well. That will make sense as it unfolds. So for me, as somebody that delivers hypnotherapy and counselling, the difference is, broadly speaking, one is passive, one is active. With hypnotherapy, it is more passive in terms of you go through a relaxation session. Counselling, completely conscious, two people talking the whole way through it, is my interpretation of the difference between hypnotherapy and counselling. Lisa, how would you answer that question? For you, what's the difference?
Well, first of all, I need to highlight that I'm a solution-focused clinical hypnotherapist.
Okay.
And there are many, many types of hypnotherapy out there.
Yeah.
So I can only really focus on what I can talk about because of my training.
Perfect.
And one of the things I'd say straight away with regards to what you said is this solution-focused hypnotherapy is very heavily client-involved.
Okay.
It's a kind of talking therapy.
Yep.
And it's backed up by hypnosis.
Okay.
So up to approximately maybe two-thirds, if not more, of the session will be myself and the client talking.
Right.
And coming up with some way of finding a solution to whatever problem it is that they've come to me with in the first place.
Yeah. Okay. How might a session be structured?
Well, after the initial consultation, which takes about 40 minutes, and where I've explained to the client how their brain works in fairly simplistic neuroscience terms,
yep.
And using easy diagrams so that they can understand it, they come to the first session already with that knowledge,
yep.
And I build on that knowledge within the sessions. So in a session, which lasts about an hour, bearing in mind in the initial consultation, I've already found out why they've come to see me and how I can help them.
Yeah.
First of all, we just focus on what's been good in the recent past.
Yeah.
And by recent past, it's sometimes literally just the last week.
Yeah.
And that can be really difficult. If they're in a low mood, sometimes they look at me like I'm a bit mad, like, you know, what do you mean what's been good? Nothing's been good.
Yeah.
But that's where I come in and I help them. And we find there are good things in every day. It might be a sunny day. It might be somebody's made them a really decent cup of tea at work.
Yeah.
It might be that they won 10 quid on the lottery. But in that part of the session, we focus on things. And they do, it might be struggle at first, but over the weeks, they come more and more thinking about what's good and what's happened.
Yeah.
And then we always do a little bit of revision about the brain. So what I taught them in the first initial consultation, I go over a little bit. And it's never a test. It's just reinforcing what they've learned already. And then we look at something in the future. And I use what's called the miracle question. And I ask them, if something had happened tomorrow to make you that little bit happier, what would be different? And I've had answers from everything from nuclear fusion to all the people in Peterborough would have somewhere to sleep for the night.
Aww.
To my garden shed will be fixed. So they come up with something that they know would make them happier. And then we go with that. And by the time we've finished that part of the session, they've got something that they know that they can do, not necessarily to take them towards nuclear fusion being established, but it will make them that little bit happier. And the way it works is it's something that they can do. It's tangible. They know they can do it when they leave my therapy room.
Yeah.
And that makes them feel positive. It makes them feel happier. And it also makes them feel that they're in control.
Yeah.
And when you feel in control, you just feel that little bit happier.
Yeah.
So after we've done the talking therapy, it's backed up by a period of trance. And trance is very ordinary in many ways. Mm-hmm. It's like when we drive our car and we think, oh, how did we get there?
Yeah.
So we do it all the time. We do it when we're reading a book and realise we can't remember what the page said. We do it when we're washing up and think, oh, we've finished, because we've gone away in our own thoughts. And I help people go into trance by talking to them, and they're listening also to some nice music. And I use language patterns and metaphors, and what I'm saying to them is also very positive. But the reason why I use trance is because when they're in a trance-like state, which basically means they're relaxed, they're able to go into their subconscious, if you like. And whilst they're in the subconscious, it backs up all the positive things that we've just been talking about, yeah. and it's reinforcing it. And trance is a bit like REM, which is rapid eye movement sleep.
Yep.
When we go to sleep at night, we have a period of sleep called REM. And this is when we process our thoughts. And we process those thoughts and we move them from one part of our brain to the other. And without getting into too much detail, when you wake up in the morning, you quite often feel more positive about things that have happened the day before yep. that might have upset you. Now, you might not be perfectly over whatever it was that happened the day before, but you will be feeling a little bit better. And that's because you've processed the thoughts and you're more able to cope with them. And you process these thoughts during REM. Now, sometimes we don't have enough REM to process all the thoughts of the day. And therefore, when we wake up in the morning, we're still feeling that little bit miserable from whatever happened the day before. And in the initial consultation, I explain to people why sometimes we don't have enough REM to process all the thoughts. Now, trance, which I've just been talking about, is similar to REM. But the point is that when we're in REM-type sleep, we might be processing lots of negative thoughts. When we're in trance, in my sessions, we've just been focusing on the good in our lives.
Yeah.
And what I'm talking to them is indirect suggestions, such as they're going to feel calmer, happier, relaxed. I don't just come up with any direct suggestions. I don't tell them what they're going to be doing. I just indirectly suggest they're going to be a bit happier in the future. And all these positive thoughts that we're thinking is getting reinforced in their brains, and they come out of trance feeling very relaxed. And one of the things I get asked a lot is, how do I know when I come out of trance? Well, all I do is I say, open your eyes, and they're out.
Yeah.
And I try and explain, if you're driving your car and you're in trance, and if a tractor pulls out in front of you, you don't have to think, oh, I need to come out of trance and slam on the brakes. No, it's automatic. And that's what it's like when you're in my room. You're in control all of the time. You're just relaxed. If you wanted to get up and walk away, you could. But most people, well, nobody's walked away because they enjoy yeah. that relaxed feeling.
Because it's not very often, I guess, that we go into that very relaxed place on a day-to-day basis. We're not massively good at that, are we, as humans?
No, we every day we work at a very fast pace of life nowadays. We never switch off. We've got social media, especially yeah. things like the news. We've always got things going on. And funnily enough, one of the things I talk about in my initial consultation is how we never switch off. And this fills our lives with anxiety and stress.
Yeah.
And there's lots of terminology around this, but I talk about the fact that we've all got what I call a stress bucket. And yeah. every day we fill that stress bucket. And one of the things I was talking about a minute ago is rapid eye movement sleep.
Yeah.
During that part of our sleep, that's when we empty our stress bucket.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you have clients, as I have, that the stress bucket can become so full, it starts overflowing.
Yeah.
And they're not waking up every morning feeling bright and breezy.
Yeah.
And that's where things like hypnotherapy and lots of other therapy, there's lots of therapies out there. I can only talk about solution-focused hypnotherapy
yeah.
because that's what I'm trained in. But there's lots of different therapies and people just have to find the one that can help them.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you say, that there is lots and lots of different types of therapies out there. And, you know, I've had people come to me and say they wanted hypnotherapy directly, and I've not been massively keen on delivering the hypnotherapy because of the subject matter. What did somebody say to me the other week? This was away from therapy, the therapy arena entirely. What was it? Something like, can you hypnotize my husband and make him love me a little bit more? This was away from the therapy arena. This was not a client. And I remember going, no. That really, really can't happen. He's either going to love you or he's not going to love you. So people have, sometimes they have an unusual, hypnotherapy for me has had a lot of bad press in the past. You know, from the TV shows that we watch and the Paul McKenna's, and it's had a lot of bad press, hasn't it?
It certainly has. And that's one thing as a clinical hypnotherapist, and I'm sure what you do in your own sessions, we're fighting against all the time.
Yeah.
About the first thing I say to people is nothing like what you see on the television.
No.
Stage hypnotists are very skilled at what they do. And yes, they can make you cluck like a chicken. I don't tend to get asked stupid questions in my sessions, but I do get asked them in the pub, like, can you make me cluck like a chicken? And I tend to reply, well, most of my clients actually want to get better, so I've never tried it, and I never would try it.
No.
So the skills may be similar. I think I use them in a more ethical way.
Yeah.
But however, I must point out, stage hypnotists, it's a good for a laugh, and they use volunteers. So those volunteers put their hands up and say they'll get on the stage.
Yeah.
So I'm not knocking stage hypnotists. I'm just saying I am a clinical hypnotherapist.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I put a shout out asking people if they would like to appear on here as a guest, you stepped forward, as many people have, and thank you for doing that. It's always good to have guests in the studio. For you, Lisa, why did you want to be on one of these podcasts and speak? What was in it for you?
One of the main, well, the probably main reason why I wanted to be on was I'm, and everybody who knows me knows about this, I'm passionate about raising awareness of mental health.
Yeah.
And I'm passionate about it because I've been there myself. I don't think you have to have had a bad time to be a good therapist, but it certainly helps because you do have that extra special empathy with the clients. I suffered from poor mental health whilst I was a student, and I've had two bad things in my late 40s. And one of them, I literally didn't get off the sofa or out of bed for 3 months. So I've been there, done that, had that black cloud, the black dog, whatever you want to call it, over my head or chasing me. And once I recovered the last time, well, probably even before that, I decided just get on with doing what I want to do and what I'm passionate about. Ironically, I was going to train to be a mental health nurse, and I was doing an access course. And whilst on the access course, and it was nothing to do with the course, one of the things I emphasise every time I talk about mental health, sometimes there isn't a reason. You never know why you feel ill sometimes.
Yeah.
We try and find reasons, but sometimes there isn't. It could be a chemical imbalance in the brain, or it could be that there's some massive event that's happened. But sometimes we don't know what the reason is. And I'm not sure why I was ill the last time I was ill. However, when I became well, I'm an accountant. Well, I used to be an accountant. I was an accountant for 30 years. And the last time I was ill, rather than returning to my access course, I fell back into accountancy because it was a safe option and I knew I could do the job easily. However, move on, say 2 years, I had an epiphany and it was like, what am I doing? This isn't what I was supposed to be doing. And I found about various things. And my brother, who's a psychotherapist, stroke counsellor, stroke many things of many years, had mentioned clinical hypnotherapy possibly 8 years ago. So this seed suddenly sprouted. I got on the internet and before I knew it, I was on the course. And that's over a year ago now. And I've got my own practice and I help people every day.
Fantastic.
But in addition to that, though, if I can just for a second go back to my question about raising mental awareness of mental health. I also do talks for free in schools, then in the local pub. I've done it to the Women's Institute. And sometimes it's talking about my own experiences because it's unbelievable. People come up to the end of them and sometimes crying, go, that's me, that's what I'm like. And obviously in the past, I could empathise, but I couldn't do anything. But now I've got more skills that I can actually help these people. And one of the free talks I do now is basically my initial consultation. It's just myself and a flip chart. It's nice in a small group. And the one thing I never realised would happen until I did it the first time was once I finished speaking, people, they do think it's great because I've taught them a little bit about the brain, but they start talking to each other.
Yeah.
And that in itself is just amazing to watch. And colleagues who've worked for each other for years look at each other like, well, I never knew that about you. And so it's like this now, opening up about it just helps the next person. And I hope it's coming across. I love what I'm doing. But behind that is this passion of raising awareness. I also linked in with that. I fundraise for Mind.
Yeah.
Because that helps raise awareness as well.
So you've just done a run you were telling me about earlier. What was the run?
I took part in the Great North Run last week with my daughter.
Well done.
And we raised £2,000 for Mind. And I'm on the way to raising £7,000 for Mind.
That's fantastic. Well done.
Thank you.
That's amazing. So I seem to remember a message somewhere where you said, I'm sure you mentioned running as, what did you say about running in terms of mental health?
Running helps me with my mental health. In my sessions, which, like I said, it's solution focused, but the idea behind it is we don't look at the problem so much as we find a solution. And I've almost by accident found the solution to my own mental health, keeping me sane, if you like, is running. You may have heard about this. I'm sure some people listening to this have heard it. There's something called Run Every Day January, which was set up by somebody called Hannah Beecham from Nottingham.
Right.
And I joined it 4 years ago. And the challenge was then run every day in January to help with mental health.
Yeah.
Now, 4 years later, this movement is actually officially linked with Mind. And they've got thousands of people that do this. So the running started off as a way to get fit, if you like. But now I've realized it helps my mental health.
Yeah.
And also I get a kick from some of the neurotransmitters, the happy chemicals.
Yeah.
I get the runner's high, which is a real thing. But you don't have to run. You can walk your dog.
Yeah.
You can go swimming.
It's about being outside, isn't it?
It is.
I say to when I'm working with clients, and if they're not massively into fitness or exercise, I say just, and sometimes I'll say you have to be outside for at least half an hour a day. It's kind of like a prescription. I'm not asking you. I'm saying I really want you to be out there. Just walking the dog, that's as much as it takes for some people. It's really interesting. You mentioned neurotransmitters there. So I go to the gym and I don't necessarily get the neurotransmitters when I leave the gym. I don't get this massive high and I don't go skipping away from the gym going, yeah, I love that. But I tell you what I do get. I feel my mood dropping if I don't go to the gym. So if I've not been for a few days, Then I feel it. So it's almost like in reverse. So then I'm like, I need to go back to the gym. I'm missing the exercises. So, and the reason I'm saying that is to share it because don't necessarily look for a high as you leave the gym, but look for how your mood changes if you don't get out and walk the dog or if you don't go for a run or look at that as well, because you don't always get the highs, do you?
No, you don't always get the highs, but whatever you do will help with the serotonin flow, which is the neurotransmitter, which makes you feel generally happier, braver and stronger. When you're doing exercise, you'll get some endorphins flowing. And funnily enough, the endorphins flow to get you through the pain of whatever the exercise is.
Yeah.
And that's sometimes, you say you might not experience the high, but sometimes when we do exercise, we get that euphoria feeling. And that's the endorphins kicking in to say, you can, a bit like when I was running last week, it's like, you can do this, just get on with it. But we can get the happy hormones, if you like, happy neurotransmitters from the things. We can get oxytocin from having a hug, and we can get dopamine from doing something that expects a reward. So we get a dopamine hit from when we eat our favorite chocolate.
Yeah.
Our brains are wired from childhood that if we eat something nice, it's going to make us feel better.
Yeah.
And that's basically because we evolved that way. If we didn't eat when we were cavemen, we would have died.
Yeah.
So even way back when we were cavemen, we got a dopamine fix. To make us eat, to make us walk that little bit further for those extra lovely berries that we knew were around the corner.
Not
so
too far away.
There's lots of ways to get the happy chemicals, but I found, and I don't, this is the thing about therapy, there's so many different therapies. I never make any suggestions to my clients, and that's not knocking any other type of therapy. It's just going back to Mind solution focused.
Yeah.
But the idea behind it is they come up with the solutions.
Yeah.
And if I, for example, said, why don't you go to run to some of my clients, they'd just look at me like I dropped off a different planet or something.
Yeah. So,
and also when we get told what to do, sometimes we don't like that anyway, full stop.
You reject it.
Yeah, it's like, well, they've told me to do that, so nope, I'm not going to do it. But if they come up with a solution, it works better. And quite often, I do find sometimes that they say to me, well, you remember when you told me to? And then they pause and go, oh, no, you didn't tell me to. I came up with that idea.
Yeah.
And I always give them credit every week. I say, brilliant, that's your idea. And the thing that I'd like to mention just really briefly is whatever it is we come up with, I never ask them if they did it.
Yeah.
Because all my sessions are about being positive. And say they came back the following week and I go, did you put the trainers by your front door so you'd go for a run? And they went, no. They're feeling negative straight away. So I never ask them.
Yeah.
But funnily enough, when I go, oh, what's been good last week, they might actually go, oh, well, I did put my trainers by the door. And do you know what? I did go for a run.
Yeah.
So it comes out that way, but I never directly ask them.
Yeah, that's good. I was thinking about happy places then when we were talking about dopamine. And although I don't get a rush when I go to the gym, I feel happy when I'm on the beach. I feel happy when I'm, and it doesn't have to be a sunny beach. It can be a really windy, rainy beach. There's something about the sea and being in that place. So everybody will have places where they just feel more alive.
Yeah, that's true. And I ask my clients every week, how happy are you? And I say, how can you be happier? What would make you happier? What would be different? And they might come out with things like that. Yeah. They'll know. And some of them, it's a walk in the woods.
Yeah.
I really like the woods, but I'm a sun worshipper.
Yeah.
So sometimes I can be a bit frustrated in the woods because I can't see the sun. But put me on a beach with a book and I'm really, really happy. And that's my serotonin flow again, because I'm in the place I want to be.
So if you chose to read a book, what would you read? Would you read fiction or would you read something that you were going to learn from?
Ooh, that's a tricky one. Depends. If I'm lying on a beach, probably not a chick flick. I'm too old for those. But something I can lose. Do you know what? Whether it's fiction or fact, it's something that I can lose myself in.
Right, okay.
So if it's a good fiction, good story, I can lose myself in it. If it's something, you know, especially aligned with what I'm doing at the moment, if I can lose myself in it, then that's my definition of a good book.
Right, okay. So that doesn't need to be either. I was asking the question because I'm a little monkey for reading books that I learn from. I seem to have lost the art of reading novels. Because I don't read a lot, because I don't think I'm a great reader in terms of my mind just wanders all over the place. It does what it wants.
That's you going into trance.
I know. Well, I was... The piece of paper that you gave me earlier, I was reading, I was like, oh, that's what I do on a page. I read, get to the bottom of the page and go, oh, goodness. Then I have to go back to the top again to reread it. I have to really focus on reading, which is not relaxing at all. So I tend not to read novels, but maybe if I read a novel, I would relax into it and enjoy it a little bit more. So maybe I'm fighting it.
I don't think that's it. I think, well, maybe you are. Maybe it's guilt because you're doing something that's... doing nothing, if you like, but it's so important. It's self-care.
Yeah.
You know, we have to switch off. And I suppose to me, yeah, novel I would use for switching off. But if I wanted to learn something, I'd probably go and choose one of the books that I've been recommended by my lecturers on my course.
So I do an exercise in therapy called What's My Oxygen? And What's My Oxygen is, I've talked about this before, is... You know, when you're on an aeroplane and they say, if your oxygen mask falls, always take your own oxygen first. Well, they say that because obviously if we don't take our own oxygen, we're going to pass out. So I do this exercise called What's My Oxygen? And it's about getting people to recognize what is their oxygen? What is it that keeps them going? It's just self-care. That's all it is. And it's really interesting because I do it with some people and they have no idea. They literally have no idea what their oxygen is. And then I give it to other people and they're able to fill it out. But I just give it to them as a prompt. I gave it to somebody that only went, I don't need you to fill it in, but take it home with you, look at it and start to consider it. And all I'm doing really is, this taps into something you were saying earlier about not telling people. So I say, just take it, keep it there. And I know just by doing that, I'm dropping a seed for them to be able to pick up or not. And there's something really powerful in that. And not saying, no, I want you to do more self-care.
So what's yours? What's your oxygen?
What's my self-care? It would be walking on the beach. It'd be walking the dogs every day to make sure that I'm outside. Oh, it could be having coffee and cake.
Oh, yeah.
So many different things. Yeah. So coffee and cake, only once a week. I couldn't do that every day because I'd be the size of a house. but, yeah.
Can I just say I'm sat opposite him and he wouldn't be?
You've not seen my family genetics. I really hope there's no family listening to that. I don't have good family genes. Self-care can be anything. Self-care can be having a pint down the pub with your mates. And you can have three pints, but as long as you walk away from that lifted, more spiritually able, then I'd say then that was a good couple of hours. If you're going to drink three pints every night of the week, I'm going to go, oh, well, you know, the balance has gone off a little bit there. That's maybe not so good for you. But self-care is so many different things for so many different people. So part of yours is running, yeah?
Yeah, I like running. And one of the most important things I do is I have space in my diaries that are blank.
Yeah.
A blank space in my diaries just keeps me going because it's like, where's that blank space? So and that's not because I don't want to literally do nothing, but I know it's my time.
Yeah. So do you actually block those out so as, or do they happen naturally?
I think as my diary fills, I recognise I need to start putting something, right, okay, block it out. Yeah, I've just read this brilliant thing. It was a book called The Brain at Work by Rattay. I hope that's right. Somebody I'm sure will correct me if it's wrong. But within about the first chapter, it talks about prioritising. And I just thought it was just great. And I've been sharing it with a lot of my clients recently. And basically, I'll try and be very succinct. We all know how to prioritise. There's loads of models out there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, having a diary is just one way. But one thing that we're all really bad at is actually prioritising doing the prioritising.
Yeah.
So if we go to work Monday, answer 100 emails, then have a chat with somebody, then do something else, and then go, oh, I ought to plan my week. Everything we've done so far has just been energy zapping, and prioritising takes loads of energy. So one thing I have started to do is I actually put in my diary, right, on that day, I'm just going to sit and look at everything I've got to do and prioritise it.
Yeah.
So now I prioritise. which is a bit of a mouthful. But when I mention it to my clients, just in passing, I get a lot of nodding heads. And they start saying, oh, but I do prioritise. I do this and I do that and I do the diary and I've got this lovely model. And I'm like, yes, but do you prioritise doing it? And then the penny drops and it's like, oh. And, I'm not brilliant at it yet. So I only read this a few weeks ago. But I just think it's a really powerful thing to do. And then within that prioritising, some time for myself. I'm going to see George Ezra next week. That's definitely my
time. Fantastic. Oh, he's a great singer. Self-care, for me, keeps us going. It is our oxygen. It's without it, we just become lesser beings than we're capable of. I quite often say to people, in my world, I'm number one. And I'm really aware how arrogant that sounds. And I go, and let me tell you why I'm number one, because if I'm not number one, then I'm not good enough partner. I'm not good enough therapist. I'm not good enough dad. I'm not good enough any of those roles that we all play. So therefore, I have to be number one and feed myself first, because then I can be good enough for everybody else.
Yeah, I try and get across the same message to everybody. That's going back to self-care. we have to look after ourselves. If we're not well, if I go to the extreme, I can get out of bed for 3 months, I couldn't help anybody at that point. So I've learnt the hard way. And fortunately, I get clients coming to me and before they're anywhere near as bad as what I was. Not always, but, quite often. And it's like catching them before they fall.
Yeah.
And or they've realised, or somebody's prompted them to go and seek help because they see they're on this descending, feeling low or angry or might be anxiety. They've got some feelings that they don't feel they're in control of. And quite often it's because, like you've just been pointing out, they've stopped looking after themselves.
Yeah.
So we cannot look. And straight away, going back to the oxygen mask, it's such a good picture to imagine. If you're on an aeroplane, if you don't put on your oxygen mask first, you're not going to save anybody else.
No.
And so it's just the same.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just the same. We were talking earlier about emotional intelligence. So in October, it is Emotional Intelligence Month. It's a phrase that not a lot of people completely understand. More and more people are beginning to understand it. We talked about it off air a little bit. What's your understanding of the term?
Sorry, deep breath. Well, emotional intelligence, this is very basic, but my understanding of it is understanding and empathising other people and recognising they've got their own thoughts and feelings, but also understanding our own thoughts and feelings. So it's taking account of the people around us, but what's also going on in our heads. And And it's really, really important. I've only touched on it, but there's lots of articles on how it can make you a better leader,
yeah,
better parent, well, a better person, mm-hmm, if you have got good emotional intelligence. And you can become good at it. You can, we've got lots of different, I've seen a diagram somewhere, we've got lots of different groupings of intelligence, and that's just one type.
Yeah.
And like all our other things that we know in life skills, we can become better at emotional intelligence.
Oh, completely. And usually through therapy, people's emotional intelligence goes up just quite naturally. It's a really good book called Emotional Intelligence 2.0. And it's a very, very business-based book. It's kind of based on a business model, but it's written in a really practical way, and I love it. The basic principle of the book is, once we understand our own emotions, our own feelings, our own kind of structures, we then become better at recognizing other people's. But we have to begin with ourselves. So that it's a little bit like me waking up in the morning and going, oh, I feel a bit grumpy. Why do I feel grumpy? So recognizing the grumpy feeling, because sometimes I do. And then I have to go, why do I feel grumpy? What went off yesterday? Have I exercised? Have I given myself self-care? What's happened? It's that awareness, that self-awareness. Where am I at today? What's happening in my head? Because then I can work with other people in similar ways. So that's emotional intelligence.
And funnily enough, that very nicely links to the initial consultation that I do with my clients, because I tell them why they feel the way they do, why they might be grumpy in the morning.
Yeah.
And I'll do it again succinctly. I just split the brain into really two simple parts, an intellectual mind and the primitive brain.
Yeah.
And part of the intellectual mind is a part of it, which is in scientific terms, if you like, is our prefrontal cortex. That's the bit that's you and I talking to each other. That's what we're using right now.
Yeah.
And most of the time, that's linked to the rest of the intellectual mind, which helps us make good decisions based on a thorough assessment of the situation.
Yeah.
We've got the primitive brain. Now, that's the brain we started out with. Well, the brain we had when we were cavemen. And within there, there's the amygdala, which is a bit like a panic button.
Yeah.
And it sends off a message to something called a hippocampus, which stores repeated behaviours. And it also sends messages to something called a hypothalamus, which releases chemicals. Now, I talk about if you saw a polar bear, you'd be frightened stiff straight away. Your anxiety would go through your roof. And your amygdala panic button would go off. A message would go to your hippocampus, and your hippocampus would look for a pattern of behavior, and it goes, you see a scary animal, you run away.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, the hypothalamus sends out loads of chemicals so that you can run away. And you're feeling so happy because you've got away from that polar bear. But going back to what you were saying, sometimes the primitive brain kicks in, just because our anxiety's gone up because of negative thinking. And the coping mechanisms of these chemicals being released, or wanting to run away from life, or maybe hide away, you know, a bit of depression or low mood, or even feeling angry, are not very useful coping mechanisms.
No.
So I explain to my clients that all we try and do, and I'm sure it's what you do yourself, we try and make our clients' mood lift by, I say, we're pulling them back into their intellectual mind.
Yeah.
And I do that by focusing on what's been good. Now, going back to very briefly to talk about REM earlier, if you're in your primitive brain and you're feeling low and anxious, it's quite possible you're not getting a good night's sleep, and you do wake up in the morning, like you said, feeling grumpy, feeling stressed. And so you need to look for a way to move forward.
Yeah.
If we're doing the self-care that you've been talking about, we've got our own ways. Mm. But sometimes we need that extra help, and that's where people like yourself and myself can help. But we can all do things. Going back to what you said, going for a walk, getting to the beach. Skegness isn't that far.
No, it's not at all.
I think you're talking about the Bahamas or somewhere.
No, not at all. I tell you what, one of my favourite places to walk on the beach is Mablethorpe. Just above Mablethorpe, there's Theddlethorpe. And if you go above that, there's a little place that I found about a month ago. What? Tiny little place with the most beautiful beach. It's amazing.
I know just above Chapel St Leonard's got a really lovely beach.
There's no one there. Well, yeah. There's Dunanook up there.
The seals.
Yeah.
That's good for happy feelings.
Yeah. I went there the other week, and I went on to Dunanook for the first time ever. I was like, I need to check this out. And there was a pile of seals there, massive pile.
Lovely.
I was like, what are they doing there? Yeah. So now it's not the Bahamas. It's just Big beaches and not many people. And there were few people there. It was amazing. So, and it's only an hour and a half away.
Should we go now?
we're going to wind up and go to the beach. Lisa, thank you so much for being in the studio.
No, thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted. And I don't mean in a cliche way. It's raising awareness.
Absolutely.
And we both want to do that. So it's good.
And that's exactly why we're here. So remember that we enjoy your listener questions. We want you to write them in so as we can answer them. If we're not covering subjects that you want us to cover, then please again write in, ask us to cover whatever you want us to cover. We just want to get the word out there. We want to raise mental health awareness and we want to try and create a happier, more peaceful world out there because it can be done. You know, these podcasts are available from the Newark Radio website. You can also get them on Guthrie Therapy's Facebook page. Please, please be happy with yourself. If you enjoy the podcast, then share it on social media. Get it out there. Let people listen to it. Thanks again, Lisa. Take care.
Thank you.
Cheers. Look after yourself. Bye-bye.